I'm speaking today with Tripp Jennings, a veteran journalist many of you may know from his coverage for the past 7 years with the Albuquerque Journal, the New Mexico Independent, and the Santa Fe New Mexican. Last year, he and fellow journalist Heath Hausman of nmpolitics.net had the extreme good fortune, certainly in the journalism world, to receive an exceptional Kellogg grant to start an organization called New Mexico In Depth, whose goal is to foster, promote, and publish journalism in the public interest. Welcome to the show, Tripp.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Can you tell us more about New Mexico In Depth and what exactly it means to promote journalism in the public interest?
Well, you know, we're 11 months old. We started in July 2012, and as a startup organization, we're still figuring out exactly what in-depth means, what our vision, what our mission means. But, you know, to put it, to sum up, I think we like to dig a little deeper and supplement some of the coverage, the news coverage in New Mexico. Primarily what's happened in the last few years in the news industry, as you know, is that there's just been this kind of, people have lost their jobs and there are fewer people in the newsrooms, and that puts a lot of pressure on newsrooms to cover sort of more of the daily stuff without maybe stepping back and maybe having a wider lens on the issues that maybe led to maybe a city hall, a city council making a decision. That might be an example of in-depth, trying to dig into maybe how healthcare and poverty, I'm moving to education, healthcare and poverty, hunger or food insecurity, as they might call it, contribute to, let's say, test scores, statewide, kind of trying to connect a lot of different issues. Because a lot of times I think it's very easy, and I have done this in my news coverage as well. There's a siloing of kind of a mission. If you're a city hall reporter, you just focus on the city hall because that's in and of itself a very complicated task to cover something like city hall or to cover a legislature or a governor. So we're trying to supplement and help news outlets here.
And how does that work exactly?
You mean the help? How it?
I know that you partner with a lot of different organizations, but how exactly are you going to be promoting these articles?
Well, if I can help maybe list some of the partners, I can tell you how we've worked in the past. We did a series of articles at Governor Martinez's two-year mark, and those stories, there are 11 stories, 17,000 words, that ran in two of our partners, the Santa Fe New Mexican and the Las Cruces Sun News. The Sun News also, because it is owned by a company that owns six other papers in the newspaper in New Mexico, those stories ran in those other six papers as well. So that's how we've gotten, in one example, some of our news coverage out to Farmington or Deming or Rio Doso, as well as Las Cruces and Santa Fe. So we're partnering with newspapers and KUNM and
And you and Heath write the majority of the articles, and then you offer them to these other outlets. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say the majority. In that Martinez series, yes, we did. Our hope is to work with journalists at our partner papers, the Santa Fe New Mexican, the Las Cruces Sun News, and work with folks at KUNM and Fronteras Desk. I don't know if you're familiar with them. But to work with them to sort of, if a reporter has a passion and their editors think that this is a worthwhile effort, we can come in and help with that package of stories. Also, we're working with independent journalists. So we're trying to spread around some of this help. Now, you know, we're two people. And like we were talking before, I also have to like do the bookkeeping for the organization, and we have to think about grant applications, and so it is only 24 hours in a day. But
you're talking to an independent journalist,
so you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly
right?
What you're talking about.
It's an extraordinary honor. I mean, it's an extraordinary opportunity, though. I have to say that.
Well, and it's a wonderful thing. And as I said in the intro, it's very unique that you get the kind of grant that you and Heath got for this. I mean, this is really an honoring of journalism in general. Can you tell us a little bit about how this came about and despite the crumbling industry, really, if there were any specific inspirations that led you and Heath to say, we need to do this?
You know, part of it, I have to say about Kellogg, they are spending a lot of money in New Mexico as a foundation. They're out of Battle Creek, Michigan. They've sort of, as I understand it, they are centering a lot of their funding in three states, Michigan, where they are, New Mexico, Mississippi, and then the city of New Orleans. And we were, I think, the beneficiaries of that kind of focusing of their efforts, because I think in the past they maybe funded a lot more places, and they probably still are, but they're focusing on these three states. And part of maybe what they were thinking is that with the crumbling, with newsrooms getting smaller, and there's less time to cover maybe more in issues at a deeper level, they thought it was probably important to get more coverage of those kind of issues. That kind of coverage, I should say, which is trying to connect the dots on, like I said, in education, how poverty or healthcare, how they influence testing scores, or you know, what does it mean to have this many uninsured people in the state? New Mexico has one of the highest rates of uninsured in the nation. For a long time, it was just after Texas. I think it's dropped in the rankings, maybe the third or fourth. But
now, we should also back up and tell the audience, you all got a $500,000 Kellogg grant, which is fairly significant. And this was over two or three?
Two years.
Over
that's
a
correct.
Two-year period to
that's
do
correct.
This.
And we had some help from McCune Foundation as well here in Santa Fe, the charitable
Wonderful.
Foundation. But it was extraordinary. And you mentioned the New Mexico Independent. If you were going to ask me how this happened, Heath and I were part of a group of journalists and bloggers who helped found New Mexico Independent in 2008. Some of the local funders of New Mexico Independent, it turned out, knew folks at Kellogg. And the New Mexico Independent sort of, for all practical purposes, went away in November 2011 when most of the staff was laid off. And that's when I went to work for the Santa Fe New Mexican, which was a wonderful experience. But in a sense, it was one of these things where some folks knew what Heath and I have done in the past, and we're looking to maybe fund some journalism.
And so, some of the specific stories that you focus on, you've done a lot on healthcare already, education, poverty. What other kind of stories are you trying to incorporate, and what elements do you still see are not being covered in New Mexico?
We just started also a Native America project in late April, where we're trying to focus more on some of the news and issues coming out of some of New Mexico's Native communities. I've been here for almost 8 years. I moved here from Connecticut, and I've not seen a lot of coverage in Native communities at the places where I've worked, and partly there's a lot of reasons for that. It's sometimes very difficult when you have a smaller staff to branch out even more. I think there are some challenges to doing some reporting on Native communities as well.
And what are some of the issues that you've discovered that you want to have covered in the Native American community?
Well, we're still learning, actually. When we started this up, each of us who's working on this project, and that's Heath, myself, but Laura Paskus is doing stuff, Bryant Furlow, with whom I worked at the New Mexico Independent, and Andy Murphy, who is a young Navajo reporter at the Las Cruces Sun News. Mm-hmm. We each wrote blogs, and my blog was about learning to listen better. I think sometimes I've lived in five different states in different regions of this country, and each time I move, there's always a cultural translation that I have to do, that I have to understand what the issues are, how people... It goes from everything from what's important and how the state budget is funded. In Connecticut, it was the income tax because of the Wall Street traders. Here, it's actually severance tax, which I didn't know much about. frankly. And the gross receipts tax is the largest tax here in New Mexico. I'm sorry to go a little, like, you know, tax code stuff on you here and all this other. But, I mean, but even beyond that, there's cultural translation. I think when you move into native communities, it's almost like a different country. And I want to learn more about that. That's what I mean about learning to listen better. I think I, as a journalist, need to learn how to listen better.
I think all journalists probably do. And I think what you were saying earlier, really about in-depth meaning, connecting the dots, mm-hmm. how issues mm-hmm. impact people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in the day we used to simply call that journalism, right?
Yes, that's right.
And now it needs to take this new form because of the dissolution of so much in-depth, so much support, financial, institutional. That's simply not happening anymore.
It is not, right.
And also being able to cover controversies. I mean, Heath writes about his inspiration being a 2006 three-part newspaper series in the New York Times that documented abuses of law and power in New York's town and village courts. And he notes this as this kind of pivotal moment of this was great journalism. So have you found in your current or past work any significant abuses of power, maybe in New Mexico, that should have been or could be better reported?
Well, I think that, yes, there's always the potential for issues, wrongdoing, scandals to be better reported. I mean, when I moved here in 2005, my fifth day on the job at the Albuquerque Journal, coming from a place where I had to cover a governor who spent, it was like a slow trickle of scandals that made him resign. This is in Connecticut, and then he pleaded guilty to corruption. All right, he went to federal prison. I had covered that, and I got here my fifth day at the Journal. Robert V. Hill is indicted by the feds. And from that point on, there was just a series of scandals involving...
Can you explain, for those who may not have been following it, Robert V. Hill and why
he was indicted? Yes, he was the state treasurer at the time. Right. And his predecessor as treasurer had basically was talking to the feds and had made a deal with the feds and Michael Montoya. And that began what was just a series of scandals here in New Mexico. And so I wonder, as I covered all these scandals, I was wondering, what is it about New Mexico? What developed? Now, that's not to say that New Mexico is the only corrupt place in the world, because frankly, in Connecticut, I mean, or Illinois or Louisiana, or you have examples out of California, Georgia, but why, how did that develop? I think maybe the easy way for me to sum up in depth stuff is we often concentrate on the how, the what, the when, the where. I really want to know why sometimes.
And have you gotten any closer to answering that question, or is that part of the project?
Well, I mean, I can give you my, you know, philosophical answer, which is I think it's the human condition. I mean, but that's not necessarily journalism, right? I mean, so, but what is it about power sometimes?
Well, we see that in so many different stories. I should note, when you speak about the human condition, you also happen to have a Master's of Divinity.
And I do.
And does that feed into a lot of your reporting? I know when you're doing kind of factual roundhouse reporting, it may not, but have you had certain insights into the human condition, and does that ever make it into your reporting?
Well, I mean, only in a very broad sense, and you and I have talked about this. I mean, it's... having a Master's Divinity and spending 3 years reading philosophy and theology is very helpful when you have to read legislation, say, because you have to do a close reading of text, and so you have to understand what things mean. You always ask, you know, how do things connect? And it also has helped me focus more on thinking, how to think about legislation, in the sense that... a lot of times it's very easy to focus on the politics of an issue, much easier than it is to focus on the policy and how it's being either tweaked or created. And that's very difficult, I think. And frankly, writing about policy is not as sexy as writing about the politics. But I'm not really that interested. I am interested in the sexy stuff, but the older I've gotten, the more I'm interested in the policy stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I've often thought in listening to journalists like Bill Moyers, who is my hero, even Chris Hedges, they also have deep theological backgrounds. And it seems that in some of the movements, like the movement of the far right in this country now, that having that kind of grounded education can be incredibly useful to counter some of the arguments that come out in the name of God or in the name of religion. And
that's a whole different subject. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, right. I mean, the thing is that I... Yes, I mean, you know, Bill Moyers is this guy who came from Texas, right? He was a Baptist minister who, you know, went to work for LBJ and then has done some stuff. I mean, I followed Chris Hedges as well when he worked for the New York Times. It's interesting because I think this, I don't know if you wanted to talk about that, but this, you introduced this idea of religion in America and this conversation and stuff. I find it often there's a lot of stuff said in the name of God on all sides by people who,
yes.
Who, it's like bumper sticker rhetoric, and when you actually kind of unpack or ask them what they exactly mean, it's like in seminary we used to talk about, well, 94% of Americans believe in God, but when you ask them what God is, then you get some really interesting answers.
Interesting.
I'm sorry about that.
No, but I think that's incredibly important because I think some people are too afraid to question the bumper sticker rhetoric because they think, well, this will I... you know, for lack of a better term, go to hell if I question this. And I think that we need to be questioning. We need to be questioning everything and exploring the complexity of all of these different religions. And journalism is such an important vehicle because this is the way the majority of people get their information, for better or worse. I think this is the reason that New Mexico In Depth is so important. I mean, you and I spoke before what I call the foxification of news. And this is, in my view, a total lack of accountability moving forward. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed the same? And are you hoping to kind of counter that in New Mexico?
I think in our conversation earlier this week we talked about this. It was this situation when I started in newspapers back in the 80s. Dating myself here. Typically, there was the hometown newspaper. You had local TV stations at the national level, before CNN. You had the three big networks, and so they were the filters, right? And people got their news that way. Now, I don't think we want to get into the conversation about how people pass around information. Informal networks, which is family and friends, versus, you know, formal networks, which is government or media. The lines are blurred now.
Absolutely.
The internet has. It is a great force for positive, and it's a great force for, I think, and sometimes negative things too, because what you have is you have all of a sudden all this noise out there that, and that makes it more difficult for people who are trying to get responsible kind of like takes on very serious issues sometimes, because there are people passing. And I'm saying this is from all sides, not just conservative or liberal. I'm saying there's a lot of stuff coming from all sides of people saying this is the way it is. And when you start to say, okay, this is the way it is, let's step back. Let's have a conversation. This is the sentence. What are the assumptions in each phrase there? And I'll be honest with you. That's one of the things that you learn in reading philosophy or theology is that you actually learn to say that sentence is made up of a bunch of assumptions. And I think that it's happening in our political discourse more and more because more and more people have access to give a voice to their feelings or their beliefs, which I think it's in some ways a really laudable thing. It's a democratization of the media, right? But it also creates some real complexity and difficulties for people who are trying to ferret out what is and what isn't.
Well, it's also difficult when they're giving voice to their beliefs in 140 characters.
And yes.
So, I mean, Twitter, yes. Twitter's been amazing. And you were actually the one who told me that this is actually an important vehicle. And that was important for me to hear and to kind of know how it's been used in Arab Spring, for example. But also how the accuracy really needs to be questioned. And there needs to be that step, too, of here's your 140 characters telling you something, breaking news just occurred, but how do we follow up and make that accurate and do the background?
Yes, and, you know, we talked about this earlier, not on this program, but, you know, earlier this week. You know, there was a friend who he sent a message over Facebook saying he had to write a paper on media, and he was saying, who did I follow during the Boston bombing? And I got all of my news
either mostly off Twitter. And the reason I did is not because of I was following necessarily people. I was watching the Associated Press. And when they had links on stuff, I went to Boston.com, which is a Boston Globe newspaper, Reuters, WBUR, which is the public radio station there. I'm a pretty traditional guy. I wanted to go where I had faith in some of the reporting. Because you and I know, in the middle of breaking news, even what you think, even what the authorities think is exactly right at the moment, turns out sometimes can be wrong later on. So you want people who know that. And so that's, you know, Twitter is an amazing tool, but it's because I follow like 250 media outlets from across the world.
Oh my God. your inbox must be terrible. And in our conversation about the news sources we followed, I often bring up when people ask me, where do I go? I go to Jon Stewart as well. I mean, just because I feel like they have such an extraordinary research department, and there you can have issues where they actually present both sides of an argument. Which is a very kind of pathetic view on American journalism today, but it really is, this is where the resources are, and this is the kind of reporting everybody should be doing. You'll hear things on Jon Stewart that will never make it to the mainstream. Yeah. but yes, I'm glad to see that there is a whole overview of things that we can follow. I am speaking to Trip Jennings, who is the executive director of New Mexico In Depth. And I would like to shift to some of the coverage you have done of Susana Martinez and her, the beginning of the term. You did an 11-part series, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show. How do you find her accessible?
You know, I'm not at the Capitol day-to-day now. I can give you a story that only tells part of the, you know, the picture, but I have to preface that by saying, you know, my experience, it's a comparison, it's a story that compares. My experience with Richardson, and when he was governor, was that every time he went to the rotunda, he was surrounded by a lot of people, and he was so large, he was 6'2", you could see him anywhere, and in some ways, he wasn't necessarily as very accessible. That was partly because his administration in the last three years was going through a lot of scandals. Mm-hmm. So it's understandable. In 2011, her first session, I was waiting to interview the Governor Susana Martinez at the Rotunda after one of those events. You know, they usually have events. And I didn't even notice when she walked right by me because she was not surrounded by an entourage. So in that way, I think maybe, you know, she is accessible. I think that given my experience with coverage in Connecticut and here in New Mexico and covering governors, that as time goes by, I wonder if that kind of accessibility is going to be limited because, frankly, anytime you're in power, you're going to be hit by your political enemies, or there are going to be missteps that happen. The email controversy, for a second,
right?
That are going to cause you to be a little gun shy and maybe a little angry at some of the media coverage because we're all human beings, right? As time goes by, there's going to be more of that, I think.
And for now, I mean, she has a very high popularity rating, and I'm wondering, why do you think that is, and what does that come from? What are the positive things that she has done so far in her administration?
Well, I think when you mention popularity, I immediately go to trying to figure out how popularity is created in the 21st century,
right,
or the late,
right,
20th century. And part of that is how one appears.
Yeah. She's very friendly. She's very
and she comes across as friendly in some of the press conferences and the newsers and whatnot. You know, and there's a way of positioning that always happens at a gubernatorial level by political consultants. Everyone has them. I think that's part of it. I think that speaking Spanish, being able to speak Spanish is that helps. That really helps. So I think that that's part of it. I think
And what's interesting to me is that she has kept that popularity, even though the economy is bad. Usually you see a popularity dip when there's an economic kind of like, just it's not good. She inherited a lot of stuff. But
She did.
That's going to be interesting. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would like to look at the other side of that. And you and I have had that. One of my, if there is any criticism at all, it's really a more critical look. For example, a lot of progressives, the environmental movement in Santa Fe, I mean, think she has declared all-out war on the environment in this state. Mm-hmm. I mean, the kind of thing she's repealed, firing members of the Environmental Improvement Board, filling key positions at the New Mexico Environment Department with anti-environmental loyalists. The list goes on, putting, when she had a small business task force, kind of filling it with oil and gas lobbyists. Why has this not really come back to bite her? Despite Supreme Court cases against her, but it doesn't seem to be.
You know, you mean come back to bite her with the public, you mean?
Yeah.
Partly I wonder if that's because when you get into environmental issues, some of this stuff is really kind of complicated. And it's not easy soundbite stuff sometimes.
That's why we have New Mexico in Depth.
Right. And so I think what you're talking about is the 11-part series, right? There was no kind of story on environmental stuff. I can tell you that we were at that point 6 months old, and we were using this almost as a test case with our two newspaper partners to see how this would work. So we picked out some issues. I have covered corrections. I've covered state budget. I've covered health care. I haven't covered environmental stuff as much. And we're only two people, and we were thinking about what can we cover. And as I told you right before the interview, you know, I sat for a year and a half right across from Stacey Matlock, who was covering all of these issues, as was other people in the state. And I thought it was kind of taken care of, and I didn't know how to expand that quickly into deep coverage of environmental stuff, because I don't really care for the he said, she said stuff. I'd rather understand why. What the other thing is politically, guess what? People appoint who they appoint. Republicans, Democrats, that's part of power. That's a perk of power. So I don't know if that satisfies your question. I think that could be part of our, you know, coverage.
Your emerging exploration. Following corruption anywhere, following the money is the lead story, right? I mean, her contributions come mostly from oil and gas, home builders, real estate, livestock and dairy. And so it's all... Will we see more of that in New Mexico in Depth as we move forward?
Well, I think you'll see some of that. I mean, I when we get into who people receive money from, you know, I think that there's really the question is the amount of money people are getting.
Right.
And I'm not.
And on both sides. On both sides. I don't mean to target Susana Martinez.
I'm trying not to dodge the question, but I think that it doesn't surprise me that she's going to get more money from oil and gas. Although, frankly, Richardson got a ton from oil and gas. So it's, you know, smart money always contributes to many sides of an election. So, yes, you'll see some of that. It's going to be, I have to say, two people trying to work with several partners. We're going to be somewhat limited by the time we have. You know, 24 hours a day, that
Absolutely.
Kind of thing.
Absolutely. Well, we'll be really excited to follow it. Thank you, Trip Jennings, Executive Director of New Mexico In Depth. And people can go to newmexicoindepth.com to find out more and hopefully contact you or give any kind of suggestions.
That's right.
But thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, thank you for inviting me.
And we're going to take a short commercial break. When we come back, we're going to hear about Center for Photographers and Lovers of Photography. Thank you so much, Trip Jennings.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Zaylee Pollan sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're speaking today with Joanna Hurley, former board chair and current board member of Center, an organization here in Santa Fe that supports, honors, and provides opportunities for gifted and committed photographers. Welcome, Joanna Hurley. Oh, you are also president of Hurley Media, which produces photography and fine arts books for artists and publishers worldwide. Can you tell us what Center is and what it does?
Well, as you said, we're a photography organization and we're not for profit. And our mission is to provide opportunities for photographers and also to support them and to create community. And one of the ways that we do that is our flagship program, which is happening this weekend, and it's called Review Santa Fe. And that's a wonderful event that brings together 100 photographers and about 50 reviewers who are museum curators, gallery owners, publishers, and other people that can provide opportunity and support for these photographers.
And what kind of photographers?
It's all different kinds of photographers, really. We started out supporting emerging photographers, or what we were calling at that time emerging photographers. In other words, people who hadn't had a lot of exposure, if you will, for their work. Now it seems that we're getting more mid-career photographers. Sometimes we get commercial photographers who have a body of work that is fine art photography and they want to get it critiqued by people who are in a position to do that or who are in a position to show it in a museum or show it in a gallery. And we also get documentary photographers. The work has really turned very much in that direction, I think, in the last 5 years, I think, because of what's going on in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, and some of that kind of photography in general is so powerful and so educational.
Yeah.
Much more so than, as you know, the previous was journalism. Sometimes photography really carries much more weight.
Well, I think it does, especially in a way these days, because a lot of our media is maybe prepackaged a bit and controlled a bit, but the photography isn't. It's although you could also argue that a lot of photography can be manipulated, but a lot of documentary photography is not so manipulated, and it has a really great impact on people because it's showing us the world that we're not necessarily able to go out and see for ourselves in war zones and in famine zones and the aftermath of Katrina, the aftermath of tsunamis, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, you mentioned the manipulation, but recently I was following a controversy around a certain photo in Syria that I believe won a big photo award, and people were saying that it was actually touched up.
Right.
Is that easy to do in some way, or does that happen? And how do people now, with the kind of technology we have, determine what might be, quote-unquote, authentic photography?
That's a really interesting and pretty loaded question. There's a lot of discussion going on in the field around that. A lot of photography is photoshopped, of course, to be enhanced. A lot of art photography is photoshopped. A lot of it is created, in a way, on the computer. But I think a lot of documentary photography is not necessarily so enhanced. And there actually are standards that photographers really try and follow, and the media that publish them really try and follow those standards to show work that is really authentic about what's going on and what's being reported on.
Well, tell me a little bit more about Review Santa Fe. I mean, this is bringing together photographers from all over the world,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
I hadn't even heard of either Center or Review Santa Fe. Granted, I'm not a photographer, but this is a really big deal.
It is a really big deal. It's kind of a best-kept secret in the arts world in Santa Fe. We've been in existence for 20 years. And Review Santa Fe has been in existence for 13 years. We're the first and I would say the most prestigious juried review program in the country. There's only one other program in the country that's juried, but it's much smaller. It's in San Francisco. And that's what really distinguishes us from other photography review programs, because the people who come to look at the work know that they're seeing work that's already been vetted by their peers, and so they know it's going to be of really high quality. And so there's always a lot of excitement around what they're going to see. And earlier in the year, we give out awards and grants to photographers, so there's a little bit of buzz usually going on around that work and around those people before people come to Review Santa Fe. And some of the award winners earlier in the year come to Review Santa Fe, so their work is shown to the reviewers. And we've actually launched some really great careers from Review Santa Fe.
Tell us about some of those.
Well, a woman named Julie Blackman, who's represented by PhotoEye here, she has a book also called Domestic Vacations that was published by Radius Books. Her work takes a really interesting influence from the Dutch painters of the 17th and 18th century, and she talks of, it's all about domestic scenes that are kind of wacky, and she sort of turns them on their head. But she also does a lot of really interesting editorial photography. Another photographer named Alex Soth, he won one of our prizes, and then I think he was at Review Santa Fe, and he went on to be chosen for the Whitney Biennial that year, which is a huge deal. That
Absolutely.
Just kind of made his career immediately. He's a wonderful photographer who came out of one of our programs.
You know, when we were talking about photography and the impact of it, I mean, one of the biggest impact in my professional life came from James Noctway and his film War Photographer,
yeah.
which was really amazing and was really kind of discussing what went into his photography. And are you in a place, having judged and taken part of this, what makes a good photo?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's a question that's actually really hard to answer in a very linear kind of way.
Yeah.
And we talk about that a lot, actually, because one of the programs that we've had is writing an artist statement, because we also look at artist statements when we look at the work, and sometimes they're just really awful and incomprehensible, and other times they're really articulate. So you sort of realize why people are taking pictures instead of writing, but usually the people that can write a good artist statement also are taking great photographs because they really understand what they're doing, and they have a really good eye, and it's really developed. And that's really what makes a good photograph. It's that you can see the vision of the artist and you can see the eye of the artist in the work. It's the only way that I can really describe it. Oh, all the elements come together, and like any great piece of art, it really hits you in your gut. And that's why Noctway's War Photography is so amazing, because you're looking at work that is beautifully photographed, technically speaking, but you're also looking at work that just completely grabs your gut and grabs your heart, and in one split second makes you completely understand oftentimes a horrific scene.
Absolutely. In that poetic way, too, you can't look away, really, because it's done so beautifully.
Yeah.
You were... The 100 people who are here, though, the 100 photographers have already been chosen. This is a process that started last year?
No, the process starts... Well, actually, I guess it did start last year. The applications, I think, are usually due in December and January. And the reason I'm sounding fuzzy about this is, as a board member, I'm not allowed to be involved in any of the selection of the artists, so I just kind of stay away from all of that. I don't look at the work until, you know, much later, till here at the reviews. And that's one of the other things I wanted to talk about, is that as a reviewer, for example, I will probably look at about 15 to 20 portfolios. But a few years ago, about 7 years ago, we realized that everybody really wanted the chance to see all of the portfolios. So we started a program called the Portfolio Sharing, and that's a public program. Anybody in town can come. It's free. And it's up on the IHM Retreat Center campus, which is at the corner of Montesol and Old Santa Fe Trail, where the Carmelite Monastery is. It's also where the Santa Fe Photographic Workshops is housed. And that event is Friday night from 6 to 8 o'clock. And I think it's in the auditorium where the Santa Fe Workshops have their space. But there'll be signs. But all the photographers will be showing their work, so you can go and look at the work of the 100 photographers. And it's a really wonderful way to just look at and experience really terrific photography, and also to get to know the photographers, to understand their process, to talk to them about what inspired them to make the work. And if you are a collector or an aspiring collector, to pick up some really terrific work at good prices before these people become super famous.
nice idea here. So people would go in and you can see the portfolio sharing. These have all been judged. So there are actually just a few events that are open to the public.
Well, actually, we have a lot of events that are open to the public. The only event that's not is the actual reviews.
Is the actual review.
Yeah. We have some exhibitions going on the campus. We have an exhibition at CCA that is going on through June 30th, so you can actually go to that anytime. And that's an exhibition of two of our award winners. These are two of our international grant winners a photographer named David Favrod, who is from Switzerland, and Ignacio Evangelista, who is from Spain. And their work is going to be up at the CCA. And I think there's a, looking here at my notes, there is an event at CCA. I believe it's tonight.
Well, people can look on your website for that as well.
Yeah, they can look on the website. And the website is visitcenter.org.
Visitcenter.org. You also have a number of seminars that are open to the public, one of which is about business and our own Jamie Stillings here in Santa Fe, who did an extraordinary series on Hoover Dam. I told you the other day it was the only photography book I think I've ever actually purchased.
Really?
Yeah, I was so taken with
it. Really is terrific work.
So I don't know if any of that will be, if he'll be presenting any of his work, but he will be presenting some of the marketing aspects. And what are some of the other seminars that people can participate in?
Well, there's a seminar with a very distinguished photographer named John Gossage, who is a Guggenheim Fellow. And that's on how to sustain a long career and new methods for engaging audiences. And there'll be some very interesting people interviewing him on that panel discussion. He'll be with several reviewers, including the senior multimedia producer for NPR, a gentleman named Keith Jenkins, a publisher and magazine editor named Michael Itkoff, with a publishing company and magazine called Daylight, which is a photography publication. And let's see, we have... Oh, and then we also have some exhibits of our other grant and award winners on the campus of the IHM. And there'll be tours open to the public of those exhibits, again on Friday during the portfolio sharing, and again on Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 o'clock. And if any of this is confusing, you can just go to the website and it's all listed there.
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who is a photographer, an aspiring photographer, or a lover of photography, this is kind of an invaluable experience to go and to see this. So this has been going on for more than a decade. How did the center come about?
Well, center was started 20 years ago by Reed Callanan, who is our current acting board chair, and he's also the head of the Santa Fe Photographic Workshops, which a lot of people are familiar with in town, and Sam Abel, who is a distinguished photographer who's best known for his work with National Geographic magazine. He also recently published a book with Radius Books. And they wanted to create a service organization for gifted and committed photographers to help them perfect their craft and to bring their work to the attention of professionals in the field who could offer them opportunity.
And it's been growing internationally. How do so many people, I mean, I looked at some of the people who submitted work here, and it's really a wide range.
Yeah, we have people from, this year we have people from 24 different countries, and we have a lot of international curators as well who come to Review Santa Fe, and we're also starting a very exciting international online review program with a new organization called IIST, and representatives from IIST will also be here. They offer an online review service. So,
and when we do review service, I mean, you're talking about people giving you any kind of critique. Is it about the work itself, or about how to market it? What kind of outlet, gallery, book publisher would be interested?
It's about all of that. A lot of the critiques are about, it's really about what the photographer is asking and about what the photographer feels that he or she needs from the reviewer. And also, obviously, it's about what the reviewer can offer. And so the reviewer is doing the review from his or her perspective. Like, when I review, I'm looking at the body of work to see if it's basically ready for prime time, if it's ready to be a book. And if I don't think that it's ready to be a book, then I critique it from that perspective on how the photographer can get it ready to be a book, how the photographer can perhaps perfect his vision or realize his vision better, how he can think about sequencing it, which is the way the images are arranged in the book, how you can think about having writers for the book. And then if I do think it's ready to be published, I think about different publishers that I work with that would be interested in publishing the book. If you're a museum curator, you're looking at it completely differently. You're looking at the work I don't want to speak exactly because I'm not a museum curator, but how the work would fit in with your collection, how you would fit it into various shows that you have coming up. And then a lot of people also, a lot of the reviewers, look at the work and really very carefully and gently and kindly tell the photographer how to make it better, if that's really something that's necessary. The one great thing, though, about Review Santa Fe, for all of us who are reviewing, is we don't usually have to have a lot of conversations like that, because this work has been vetted and these people are usually pretty experienced. When you go to the other review programs where they're not juried, it's just a general call for, you know, for work done on a lottery system, you can really sometimes look at work that is not ready to be published or shown at all.
Now, is this something that's only really available during this annual review session, or is the center available for consultations like this year-round?
If you're a member of Center, we do have a membership program. You can, I think there's a site up, on the website where you can go to arrange a consultation with one of our other members, like myself or museum curator, or gallery owner, or some other publishers.
We're talking with Joanna Hurley, a board member of Center. They are having a big event this weekend, Review Santa Fe. 100 photographers will come in, and the public is invited to come and view some of this work. Let me ask you, where does some of the funding come from for Center?
Well, this year we're very excited because we have our first NEA grant.
Congratulations.
Yes, we're very excited, and that will allow us to provide even more scholarships than we already do to Review Santa Fe and also to exhibit and show the work. I think the grant has a very specific name. It's called an Artworks Grant, which supports the creation of art that meets the highest standards, provides public engagement with diverse and excellent art, and lifelong learning in the arts and the strengthening of community. So we really want to thank the NEA for that grant. We also are supported by the New Mexico Arts Division, and we have been supported by the McCune Foundation. And then
wonderful.
Individual donations, and we do have a membership program as well.
And just quickly before we close up, I'd love to go back and touch on the idea of documentary photographer. And in an earlier conversation, you had mentioned this is not just pretty pictures. You know, we're talking about incredibly important news conveyance at this point. Can you tell me a little bit more about some of the documentation that either has been shown or will be shown and the importance of photography in that sense?
Do you mean specific bodies of work that I've seen?
Specific bodies of work, and also generally, you've spent a lot of time looking at a lot of photographs and you have some very strong opinions about documentary photography specifically.
Well, there's a real conversation going on in the field about what is documentary photography anymore, because there's so much of it, but there's so much of it that isn't necessarily what you would call straight documentary photography a la Dorothea Lange, but there's a lot of work out there that's really about engaging with communities and events and serious struggle that's going on around the world. In terms of one of my favorite bodies of work, actually it's several bodies of work that I've ever seen, was at Review Santa Fe, I think around 2005, and it was from a Colombian photographer named Erica Dietes, who I'm going to be working with George F. Thompson Publishing to publish her book next year, and it's photographs of the disappeared in Colombia. And it's not obviously photographs of the disappeared themselves because they're disappeared, but it's photographs of articles of clothing that were given to her by their families, and she photographed them in water where they were drowned. And then mounted
powerful
them on
work.
Glass, and it's really powerful work.
Wonderful.
Because when you first look at it, you don't really know exactly what it is. It's just beautiful work, and then when you find out what it is, it really, really socks you in the gut.
And I suspect that people will be able to see a lot of photography like that this weekend. So I hope that a lot of people are able to go. Thank you so much, Joanna
so
Hurley.
Well, thank you, Saley.
Center this weekend.